today's presentation is based on a paper in which I address the question how Afghans in the wider diaspora come to engage with their country of origin in certain ways. And I build on the analysis of transnational activities that are directed towards different spheres of engagement, and what that is I will explain in a minute. I draw on qualitative data, and by drawing on qualitative data, I hope to explain how members of Afghan diaspora groups exercise agency while engaging with their country of origin on the one hand, and the structural environment in which they are embedded on the other hand. But before specifying the underlying puzzle of this talk a bit more, I will give a very brief introduction to the Afghan diaspora as well as my methods of data collection. So as most of us are probably familiar, Afghanistan has been a scene of violent conflict since the late 1970s, and these decades have left scars on the country, its people, as well as its infrastructure. Conditions of political instability still prevail, as we all know, and Afghanistan remains dependent on international aid. Over time, Afghanistan has become the largest origin or the origin country of one of the largest refugee populations in human history. So renewed episodes of conflict have led to various waves of out-migration and large-scale internal displacement as well. Over all those years, Pakistan and Iran have been receiving the majority of Afghan refugees, but also across Western Europe, Afghan populations are growing, with Germany and the UK being, at least statistically, much of this may be changing at the moment, the most important destination countries. So Afghan populations incorporate people from different migration experiences, obviously. They also incorporate representatives of different generations, of different ethnic groups, as well as different political affiliations. And further aspects of heterogeneity derive from the socioeconomic as well as the educational backgrounds, but also from varying levels of integration into the respective receiving society and varying levels of intensities of ties which people maintain with Afghanistan. Empirically, I build on 55 in-depth interviews with people of Afghan origin, which I conducted in Germany and the UK between February 2012 and January 2013. In the UK, I'll just give you a brief, quick overview of my field sites. Just to give you roughly two geographic views of Peckham. My main field sites were around the Greater London area, but I also carried out additional interviews in the north and south of England, as well as the British Midlands. And my field sites in Germany, as you can see, were equally scattered across the country. But most interviews were conducted in Hamburg, in the Frankfurt area, as well as the Cologne Bonn area. And then I did several other supplementary interviews in Munich, Berlin, and other areas in the Ruhr Valley. In addition, I was a participating observer at occasions that allowed me to capture additional facets of my interviews' social environment. And such occasions would include primarily events that were organized by Afghan community associations in both countries. My sample, I should say, is selective because many of the interviewees I engaged with do actually carry out active engagements that is related to Afghanistan, and they are members in that sense of religious association, of different community initiatives, and most of these initiatives would be pronouncedly dedicated to something that would be related to Afghanistan, or even explicitly the development of Afghanistan. And of course, these specificities limit the scope of my paper in general, but at the same time, they sharpen the focus as far as my analysis of the social embeddedness of transnational engagements is concerned. Now, moving on to the actual puzzle that I engage with in this paper, and this derives from continuously expanding interest in diasporas as social actors. So usually, diaspora activities in countries of origin and reception are studied with regard to their political or their development impact. And this has led to diasporas being celebrated as development agents and extended members of their home nation. In this context, however, there is a tendency to frame diasporas as autonomous groups and decision makers whose home country engagements are motivated by rational economic or psychological considerations. But I think that such perceptions of diaspora are essentialist because they conflate territory, ethnicity, belonging, and teleology. And they, in that sense, reify the assumption that diasporas have roots in a certain place and that they share a clear-cut group identity with people originating from that place, and with the aim of adding a little bit more analytical nuance to the debate, the underlying question which I raise in this paper simply asks how do members of Afghan diaspora groups come to engage in activities that are directed to specific social contexts in countries of origin, but also in countries of reception. So I'm drawing on two basic concepts, and one of them was developed by Nick Van Heer, who in a recent paper suggests that one way to analytically refine the debate on diaspora engagement is to disaggregate it according to the public and private spheres in which it may occur. So what he does is identifies three what he calls spheres of engagement. And these three spheres of engagement feature different combinations of the private and the public. So first, there is the sphere of the household and extended family, which is largely private and personal, and it is restricted to members of the extended family. Second, there's the so-called known community sphere, which is more public because it delineates connectivities of people that know each other or that know of each other. And most engagement in the known community sphere is directed towards spaces that those engaging have a personal connection to. But essentially, it addresses wider groups than members of people's extended families. Lastly, there is the largely public sphere of the imagined community, which refers to wider social entities. And here, of course, we draw on Benedict Anderson and his concept of imagined community. Wider social entities, such as the nation which one has an affinity without necessarily knowing its members personally. And the imagined community may include ethnic, national, or other allegiances. Distinguishing between different spheres of engagement is useful because it helps us to systematically differentiate various scopes and forms of engagement. But at the same time, the typology is largely restricted to the receiving end of the engagement, and it does not really include a more nuanced analysis of the contexts in which individuals or groups of actors initiate their activities. And what I suggest is that elements of relational sociology offer a new way to analytically refine understandings of diaspora engagement. So now I'm introducing the actual theoretical framework of analysis. So a relational approach situates the studies of diasporas amidst the structures of social relations, which not only encompass interpersonal ties and specific links to the countries of origin and reception, but these relations also include politics, economy and culture at global as well as the national level. So basically the context in which these interpersonal or intergroup ties are situated. Relational thinking builds on the assumption that social actors only exist within these dynamic or such dynamic networks or structures of relations, and it therefore rejects on the one hand the idea of rational actors and on the other hand pure structuralism. To address the question how members of Afghan diaspora groups come to engage in activities directed to countries of origin and or reception, I specifically reconceptualize the idea of agency from a transnational or from a relational, I should say. There are various approaches to conceptualizing the way social actors navigate within their structural environment. All these approaches acknowledge that the importance of social structures in understanding social actors and social action. But there is considerable variation with regard to the room that's actually left to agency and actors' ability to effect social change. So with the aim of responding to the variable and changing ways in which actors relate to such situational dynamics, Mustafa Emirbayev and Misha, two US-based sociologists, provide a more nuanced account of human agency. For them, agency encompasses three constitutive elements which express different temporal orientation. And now it's getting a little bit cryptic because they have a very specific terminology to return to these dimensions. So first of all, they outline the iterational element of agency, which they see manifested in actors' abilities to recall tacit schemes of action that were developed through past interactions. And these include, for example, corporeal, affective, and cognitive patterns, which are reflected in embodied practices and forms of social organization. So secondly, there is what Emirbayev and Misha call the projective element of agency. And this projective element of agency underlines that actors not only draw on such habituated past routines, but also invent new possibilities for thought and action. So this is the creative dimension of agency, which enables actors to enhance or to distance themselves from schemes and habits and to act in accordance with evolving desires and purposes. Now finally, we have a mediating element, which is the practical evaluative element of agency, and that responds to the situational demands of the present, as Emirbayev and Misha conceptualize it. Through practical evaluation, actors adjust routine dispositions or newly imagined projects to their respective real-world circumstances. And this dimension of agency is essentially about contextualizing social experiences. Of course, empirical action entails all three constitutive elements, but those occur to varying extents. And I hope to make that a lot more clearer when I actually apply this tripartite dimensional definition of agency to my empirical data. So anyway, although all these three dimensions of agency are likely to occur in any instance of empirical action, one is likely to predominate in any given situation. So the tripartite concept of agency is relational in the sense that agency is considered inseparable from the unfolding dynamics and of situations in which people are embedded. And they require actors to simultaneously engage with different dimensions and different layers of the structures of relations that constitute their respective environments. Now, most accounts on transnational involvements of diasporas recognize structural opportunities and restrictions, but they usually tend to ignore how actors themselves frame their engagements considering the relational environment in which they are embedded. Actors' considerations or orientations may vary according to the different situations to which they respond. And this is reflected in different narratives which reveal how actors navigate within their respective social or structural environments and make use of the resources they have available. The tripartite conceptualization of agency thus enables me to approach diaspora engagement from a more actor-oriented perspective, and therefore a really new perspective and approach to current debates. So leaving the conceptual bits, or the conceptual framework behind, I now move on to the empirical dimensions, which will hopefully illustrate what I've tried to describe so far a bit better. I'm starting off with the observation that Afghans in Britain and Germany engage in a full plethora of transnational activities, and these activities which I observe in the field vary according to the extent they are oriented towards private or public spheres in Afghanistan, and they very much match Vandier's categorization of different spheres of engagement. But, at the same time, this distinction is a first step towards identifying what Eva Muraska has referred to as the enabling and constraining structural opportunities or dynamic limits of the possible and the impossible within which people conduct their activities. So through the narratives of engagement, people situate themselves and their respective practices in social contexts, or structures of relation to stable in the relation of terminology. The discussion of my findings in the remainder of the paper is organized according to the three constitutive dimensions that Imebaya and Mischa have developed, and I discuss them under the headings of habit, imagination, and judgment, which are synonymous with the rather cryptic terms or notions of iterational, projective, and practically evaluative agency. The analytical distinctions which I draw between observed forms and agency are based on what I identify as dominant in a given context. But, as I noted earlier, it's important to keep in mind that all constitutive dimensions of agency are inherent to any empirical instance of action, albeit to varying extents. So, moving on to the first observed dimensions of agency, what I term as habit or iteration agency. This is expressed through the application of tacit or taken for granted schemes of two present actions. But this dimension of agency is not solely deterministic as we might think. In the following, I examine how iterational agency is expressed through informants' narratives of engagement with their country of origin on the one hand, but also with their diasporic context on the other hand. I discovered that narratives of attachment to Afghanistan are a fundamental part of informants' identities. Despite the physical and often temporal distance, Afghanistan is constantly present in the lives of most informants. For many, both personal ties and memories of Afghanistan forge a sense of attachment to the country, and to some extent this has a stabilizing influence on informant social identities and also to the meanings which they ascribe to the homeland on the one hand and to their diasporic livelihoods on the other hand. And this is why I consider narratives of home country attachment as one expression of habitual agency. In many cases, feelings of attachment are coupled with a sense of solidarity and a commitment to the future destiny of Afghanistan and the Afghan people. Considering the needs of Afghanistan and the Afghan population, many of my informants are determined to give something back to their country of origin and to improve local living conditions to the best of their abilities. The stark contrast between livelihoods in Afghanistan and their own livelihoods in a Western country, of course, additionally amplify informants' perceived obligations to share some of their relatively good fortune. Engagements in the family sphere are a key example of practices that are driven by such iterational agency elements. Family-oriented engagements revolve not only around acute needs, but are also based on deep-seated solidarity. Informants thus provide transnational support, and at the same time they sustain crucial elements of their identity and habituated patterns of social organization. Feelings of attachment and solidarity, however, are not primordial or unconditional, but they are strongly mediated by events in Afghanistan, and these events can transform habituated relationships between people and their place of origin. So the way that people draw upon the past as reference point very much varies as a result of changes. And these changes then affect expressions of solidarity and also forms of practical support provided to relatives living in the country. Political transformations in Afghanistan are one example for such changes, and amended practices and can lead people to amend their practices that they carry out on a transnational level. But although such practices may be amended, they can transform into new habits over time, which also suggests that habituated practices may incorporate or derive from instances of practical evaluation, so people revisit what they're doing and they might adjust their practices according to newly arising needs and demands. Yet, habitual elements or habitual schemes can also be an impediment to engagement. One example are mutual perceptions of people in the light of political or ethnic backgrounds. Many informants that I encountered in both countries emphasize that cooperation among Afghans is difficult, or as they say, Afghans find it hard to accept other Afghans. As a result, informants thought that not every organization is approachable for everyone, and that particularities often weigh heavier than feelings of solidarity. In order for social divisions between groups of Afghans to persist, people need to exercise again iterational agency through which they act upon and reproduce these tacit and taken for granted patterns of conduct. And this is what I will illustrate with an example. And the example is based on the experience of Yahya, one of my informants from Greater London, who aimed at establishing a pool of Afghan experts from different backgrounds who could advise British agencies on Afghanistan-related matters. He was very keen to form an advocacy group around what he called inclusive Afghan national interests, but motivating people to unite their efforts and work toward a shared goal turned out to be very difficult. And he says, well, I wanted it to be an inclusive group. Inclusive in a way that you include all ethnicities in Afghanistan. Because that's how the divisions basically are in Afghanistan. So I wanted it to be inclusive. Yet, Yahya admits that it has been a hard task for me to hold people together. One, these divisions, political divisions and their personal divisions, problems that individuals have with each other or get with each other, so it's really hard. It's really hard working with Afghans is really hard. It's the hardest thing. Yahya repeatedly emphasized the desirability of a more integrative national identity, which would enhance a sense of coherence and also shared ideologies. But the relational setting in which he sought to launch his initiative was strongly marked by, well, instances of segregation among the groups of people that he tried to work and cooperate with. And therefore, Yahya failed to create momentum that was based on a shared idea of inclusive Afghan interests, and he was unable to put his idea for engagement in what would essentially be the imagined community sphere into practice. And what this example suggests is that patterns of mutual perception which sustain people's identity are routinely incorporated in practical activity. Divisions between different subgroups of Afghan diaspora populations constitute one important dimension of the context in which these activities are initiated. And they derive from habituated patterns of social consciousness and social organization, but perceptions of being Afghan or part of Afghan culture can also change according to specific historical and local circumstances. And I'm trying to capture these relations between different dimensions of agency graphically. So what I'm trying to depict in this with the graph is that habitual or iterational dimensions of agency do play a key role in shaping informants' ideas and practices. And examples for that would be the often encountered emphasis on solidarity, trust, but also biased perceptions of other groups of Afghans in the diaspora. But there is a very strong relationship between habit and judgment. Thus, the bold errors of really navigating within the present situation and seeing to what extent perhaps strategies or aims need to be adjusted. So in that sense, practical evaluation is a mediator between habitual ideas and practice and the requirements of the given situation in which people find themselves. So, at certain phases of their lives, individuals may then create new strategies type of different spheres of engagement. And this then leads me to the next section in which I focus more closely on agency in terms of imagination and future orientation, which is the projective dimension of agency that builds on the idea that human agents not only repeat past routines but also invent new possibilities for thought and for action as well. And to explore this creative dimension of agency in the context of diaspora engagement, I shift my focus to informants' engagements with desires and purposes that are oriented towards the future. Informants' ideas of change and development to some extent, and not only their ideas but also concrete forms of engagement, always entail an element of projective agency because they're carried out with the intention to contribute to improving the current conditions in Afghanistan, regardless of the concrete sphere they may be directed towards. Both ideas of change, but also different forms of engagement revolve around the improvement of future conditions in the country. For example, informants exercise projective agency when they refer to their aims of strengthening Afghanistan's young generation. Strengthening future generations of leaders, as they say, is seen as overcoming Afghanistan's legacy of conflict and prevailing conditions of bad governance, as well as the country's faltering economic development. Thus, many of the observed activities aim to promote education and enhance prospects of young people in Afghanistan, who will then ultimately be shaping the country's future. So instead of succumbing to the perceived impediments that derive from current conditions in the country, informants try to find a way and respond to the identified need for change. And most engagements that seek to strengthen Afghanistan's young generations are carried out in the known community spheres. And concrete examples for such initiatives would be school building projects that try and promote education and vocational training or vocational skills. And all this indicates that although people act upon their projective aims, they seek to situate their activities in a trusted network or in a trusted environment. So informants carefully consider with whom it is best to cooperate and who they can actually launch or engage with in the country of origin. So, and such structures of cooperation then again represent environments of trust and familiarity. So structures, and these are structures that emerge more from habituated interpretations and networks of trust and are hence crucial factors and enabling factors of these engagements, and they are driven that are eventually driven by projective considerations. So there you see a very strong convergence of both dimensions of agency. Projective and future-oriented considerations can also be directed to life in Germany or the UK and lead people to minimize their involvement with the country of origin. Several informants stated that securing a livelihood in their destination country takes precedence over engagements in Afghanistan. Establishing new livelihoods in Europe entails opportunities and difficulties at the same time, and especially upon arrival, many of my informants confronted numerous challenges, such as integration into the labor market, mastering a foreign language, and coping with the sociocultural and sociopolitical environment that would not necessarily be welcoming. And tackling these challenges then requires people to make significant efforts. And as a result, their projective agency is more oriented towards life in the receiving society rather than focused on conditions in Afghanistan. And Abu Kabir, who is one of my British informants, exemplifies this when he says that if people don't see their future here, they won't think about the future. For example, if I don't have a legal status here, I can't think of doing anything for the future. They don't have a plan for the future. They first want to settle here. Once they have settled, they can think about the future. People who have settled with their families, they can think about their future. They want to do something for their kids, for their family, so they can benefit from it. Projective instances of agency, as a result of which informants focus on their future livelihoods in Britain and Germany, also entail practical evaluative elements as people respond to the requirements that are part of their receiving countries and the given situation that they're in. On a few occasions, I identified projective considerations that revolve around informed perceptions of local Afghan communities as well. Often the idea of a more integrated Afghan community derives from informed frustration with the segregated and conflictual nature of Afghan populations, which Yahya's example in the previous section has illustrated. So informants do not frame this heterogeneity of Afghan diaspora in negative terms alone, but they also emphasize positive contributions of diversity. And in such cases, habituated patterns of thought and conduct provide fertile ground for projective agency, which enables people to mobilize or articulate or work towards their ideas for a better Afghan community, or what they call, refer to as a better Afghan community. And such interplays of habit and imagination are at the heart of most engagements that are found to be directed towards the imagined community. So this is an adapted graphic depiction. And the bold arrow in the image now depicts or tries to capture that there's a strong link between habit and imagination. And as highlighted throughout the section, the desire to contribute to a better future for Afghanistan reflects both projective and habitual dimensions of agency. And the same applies to concrete engagements through which informants act upon these desires. Yet at the same time, there is again this mediating element of practical evaluation, which then basically channels engagements into certain forms and then helps people to find a middle ground between their habitual schemes but also their future or their projective orientations. And this is something I'm now going to look at a little bit more detailed in the last section. So judgment or practical evaluation constitutes the dimension of agency through which actors respond to the demands and contingencies of the present. So through practical evaluation, actors contextualize their experiences and also their desires, and most of the observed activities and engagements involve practical evaluation, as we have seen until now. The notoriously volatile situation in Afghanistan affects how people relate to the country, and it also affects forms and aims of engagement. So in many cases, personal well-being and safety are contrasted with these huge risks that informants associate with journeys to Afghanistan or with engagements that require extended stays in the country. The experience of Krishna, a young woman I met in the UK, exemplifies how informants use practical evaluation to accommodate habitual feelings of attachment to Afghanistan, but also the perceived impediments that derive from the country's endemic security problems. During a visit to Afghanistan, Krishna felt strongly confronted with the fragile situation. Simultaneously, she stresses her general affection for the country, saying that, "I love it there. I absolutely love it there. I mean, yes, of course, the country is not in a very stable position. But you know, your country is your country." Yet when she was offered an opportunity to stay and work in Afghanistan, she felt reluctant to compromise her secure livelihood in the UK. So it was her uncle that offered her a job. And he said that, "By all means, if you wanted to work here, I could get you a job." Because he works for the government, he's based, and he has his contacts. "So if you wanted to work here, by all means, I could get you a job, and then you could serve for your own Afghan people." And then she replies, "I would love to do that, but just, once again, just the security. Just, I don't know, it's just that I'm quite reluctant, otherwise I'd love to." So in the end, Krishna declined her uncle's offer to work in Afghanistan. And at the same time, she stepped up her engagement with Afghan communities in Greater London. She became an active member of an organization for young UK-based Afghan professionals, and as part of the organization, she's involved in a project for orphans in Kabul, an activity that I classified as non-community engagement. While unwilling to break with their habitual livelihood in the diaspora, informants do seek ways that allow them to act upon effective relationships with Afghanistan, despite the ambiguities that arise from, for example, the volatile security situation in the country. Through practical evaluations, informants respond to several elements of their relational contexts. And these include livelihoods and future prospects in the UK and Germany, the fragile situation in Afghanistan, as well as the opportunity to get involved in local community initiatives. And practical evaluation, in that sense, can help people solve the dilemma of wanting to act upon their emotional attachment to a place and their projective ideas of change, while considering real-life impediments that they encounter on a daily basis. Likewise, we need to bear in mind that informants may consciously decide not to participate in organizations and undertake engagements or undertake transnational engagements. And not participating, I think, is as much an expression of agency as transnational engagements are. So informants are very well aware of the opportunity they have at hand. And as a result, they use their freedom to act on what seems best to them. Some informants use the metaphor of silent spectators, for example, with reference to those whom they perceive to be less readily engaged in the Afghan diaspora. But being a silent spectator does not necessarily mean that people are passive. In many cases, it is actually a reflection of the way people practically evaluate and act upon their current situation. And such findings suggest that the diaspora, or that diasporas are agents, but not necessarily agents of change according to the modernist understanding of change and development, which revolves largely around improvements of economic welfare in those countries. Focusing on practical evaluative aspects of agency helps us understand which elements of diasporic livelihoods are considered when people engage or likewise refrain from engaging in transnational practices. And therefore, Imebaya and Mishu's tripartite concept of agency allows us to see how the drivers of engagement are negotiated amidst local, social, and institutional specificities of informal, relational, and structural contexts. So, how are these different dimensions of agency now linked to spheres of engagement? The theory-driven analysis of my empirical findings suggests that the engagements that I observed are directed to different spheres, and they also involve different dimensions of agency. And engagement in different spheres, in that sense, are an expression of agency, but on the other hand, at the same time, agency can alter or create spheres of engagement. And this happens if changes in informants' relational context, such as, for example, events in Afghanistan or the receiving countries, as well as experience of specific intergroup dynamics, etc., occur. And these changes may then prompt them to rethink or adapt patterns of thought, ideas, envisaged aims, and actual engagement practices. To conclude, as a concept, I would say that spheres of engagement works very well to specify the social entities or social contexts towards which transnational engagements are directed. However, we do require supplementary clarification as to why people direct their engagement to different spheres. And I demonstrated how different dimensions or different elements of informants' relational context have constraining or enabling effects on social and transnational engagement. Most importantly, I explained how informants respond to the opportunities and restrictions which they encounter by exercising different forms of agency. And this shows that there are multiple ways in which the building blocks of diasporic livelihoods affect transnational engagements. And what emerged is that both endogenous structures and dynamics of Afghan populations, as well as people's embeddedness in the receiving societies, have very strong bearings on their transnational engagements. And these factors, often in conjunction, then influence aims of engagement on the one hand, but also the resources that people are actually able to mobilize. Based on my close examination of agentic narratives, I contend that we cannot assess the agency of diasporic groups by focusing exclusively on the transnational practices which they direct towards the respective country of origin. Rather, the primacy of outcomes which dominates studies of diaspora engagement tends to turn a blind eye to the instances in which agency is actually exercised. How and under which conditions people exercise agency, however, only becomes intelligible if we broaden our understanding of the multi-layered conditions under which members of diasporic groups act upon their specific relationships with their country of origin and reception, as well as with their embeddedness in social networks and their ideas of change and development. So considering the potential effects of transnational activities, diasporic groups may be agents of change. As such, however, they do not solely act upon their attachment to their home country. There are various reasons why people choose to engage in specific activities. And actual practices become more intelligible if we approach them from a relational perspective that considers people's social position in relation to their countries of origin and reception, as well as to fellow groups of Afghan diasporas. And making the effort to disentangle the effects and variabilities of multi-layered structures helps us to gain a more precise understanding of why people engage with their home countries in certain ways and what forms of agency are involved if people choose to take action. and this is why I stop and hand the floor over to you and your questions.